A few months ago, my mom started talking to me about jumping out of an airplane. My 74-year-old mom, who's not at all physically adventurous or any kind of adventurous. She doesn't ride bikes or go jogging. She doesn't even eat at new restaurants. Like, the most adventurous thing she did before this whole airplane thing was probably fall asleep one night without her heating pad.
Makes sense to you?
Yeah. Does it make sense to me? I mean, when you first told it to me, yeah. I just was shocked. Because you're not that kind of person. Like, what do you mean you want to go skydiving? It just seemed crazy.
Yeah, you know, obviously, because, I mean, who at my age will do it and it will be considered sane?
The whole thing started with a loss. The kind of loss that subtracts from your life something so central that you no longer really know who you are. About a year earlier, her husband, my father, who was a super vital guy, was diagnosed with a rare stomach cancer and died within a few weeks.
Healthy, athletic, to death. It just did not compute in your head. What went wrong here?
They'd been married for 51 years, and they did everything together. Everything. Like, he drove her to the subway every morning, he picked her up in the evening, he made her tea every night. And it had been that way for over 50 years. Every inch of their lives, they had walked together. And my mother had no way of understanding her life story without him.
Do you feel, what thoughts about Ellie's death were going through your head over and over?
Could I do more? Did we miss anything? Why didn't I just take him and went to another hospital? All day long it hit me. Could I've saved him?
Month after month she went on like this, scratching circles into her brain, unable to make her way out.
Don't want to eat, I don't want to cook, I don't want to, completely stuck.
But then, as the first anniversary of his death approached, I got a text which suggested a very different kind of thought had bloomed in her head. It was a link to a place called Skydive Philadelphia. A photo of a guy doing two thumbs up and a really happy-looking woman. And the word, interested? Honestly, no. I was not interested. I mean, I am really terrified of heights. Like, I can barely look out a third-floor window. I knew my brother had gone skydiving in college, so I called him up, thinking maybe he would go with her instead.
No, I'm not doing it. I did it already.
And?
And it's psychotic.
But what do you mean it's psychotic? Like, why?
Okay, go to something that says granny, skydive, fail.
That's where you're sending me?
Yeah, no, go to YouTube.
All right.
Watch it. No, seriously, just watch it while you're on the phone with me and see what the hell happens here.
Okay. Granny really does not want to get out of the plane. She's gripping the sides of the door. So the skydiving dude, he has to pry her hands off the side of the plane and then shove her out.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Keep looking.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
As they free fall, her butt starts to slip out of the harness that's attaching her to the parachute. And then she keeps slipping until she's practically hanging from her ankles by this little strap in the sky.
Ah!
Granny makes it to the ground alive, but barely. Why did you show me this?
Because your mom's about to embark about something as stupid as that.
Wow, this was like really not helpful. This was really not helpful.
No, I wasn't trying to help you.
All right. If I was going to be a good daughter, I needed a reason to jump. So I texted her, why do you want to do this?
All right, can you just read what you texted to me?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Up there, we'll say hello and we'll meet someday.
That was her idea. Up there, she would catch a glimpse of her husband, deliver a message.
Yeah, that's exactly the thought, you know? We'll say hello to him and we'll tell him we're going to meet someday again. And this is to give you some really comfort, you know? That you know, you're hoping that you will really see him one day, you know, no matter where, no matter what. But that's exactly what I want. Yeah, you will be great.
It was a little death wishy, but you'd have to have a heart of coal not to be moved by this ballet in the air. My dad leaps from above, my mom from below. They meet for a second and then separate, but vow to meet again soon. The end.
All right, guys, I'm going to start getting load one trained up.
Load one? I'm so excited.
Welcome to Invisibilia. I'm Hannah Rosen.
And I'm Elise Spiegel. Invisibilia is a show about all of the invisible forces that shape human behavior, our beliefs, concepts, emotions. Today, we have a story about a reality TV show that attempted to change the narrative of a country under siege.
But first, a story about grief. We ask, what is the best way to lose? We look for clues in grammar, in my mom's experience of jumping out of an airplane,
and by talking to a beekeeper who thinks he's been swindled by Russian mobsters. Here's Hannah.
After my father died, I found myself constantly drawn to stories about loss. People losing their job, or their house, or their dog, or their democracy. It felt like what was inside my head was happening outside, everywhere. When my son lost his tooth, I drew the line. No more losing. I refused to give it to the tooth fairy. Instead, I woke up at 3 a.m. to steal it from under his pillow, and then started obsessively fantasizing about how I could put it back in its rightful place. His mouth. When my husband accidentally donated a bag filled with our most beloved baby books to the local library sale, I started to panic. So at dawn on the day of the sale, I woke up, I biked to the library in my pajamas, and accosted the ladies running the sale to let me find my bag among the hundreds of bags, and I found myself standing in the middle of the street in my pajamas, holding our old Richard Scarry book. Why? Why did I care so much about some old Richard Scarry book? Why couldn't I get on with it? So while I was in this funk, I came across a story in a California newspaper about this guy who seemed just as lost as I was. I had to start over from scratch, is what he'd said. I couldn't get that line out of my head. In the middle of his loss, this man was reaching for something. He was trying to get on with it, too. And that's how I ended up in Shoto, Montana, a beautiful small town at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, at the farm of Lloyd Cunniff, who's a beekeeper.
Hi. I just can't believe this is what you get to look at every day.
Lloyd is a compact guy with glasses. He isn't easily riled up or impressed.
It looks so beautiful.
Oh, yeah. It's nice and quiet.
Lloyd and his wife, Brenda, moved here to Lloyd's grandfather's farm about 25 years ago to build their small family bee business, Beeline Honey Company. Since then, beekeeping has gotten automated and commercialized, but not on their farm. As global forces were completely reshaping beekeeping, Lloyd and Brenda were somehow finding ways to hold on to the past.
We sort the darker combs from the lighter combs so that you get nicer honey, and we do it the old-fashioned ways.
Every morning, they woke up and checked on their colonies one by one, just like you check on children in their rooms.
Go see what the girls are doing.
That's awesome.
And for years, it was fine. It was hard work, but satisfying. And then in 2016, the first big blow. Their bees had been hit hard by something called colony collapse disorder. You've probably heard about it. It's this kind of mass exodus of worker bees that destroys the hives and has decimated lots of beekeepers.
We lost half of our bees.
They were down to their last 500, 488 hives to be exact. And then came the second blow. It was dry that year, and their honey crop from the remaining hives was meager. Honey was their sole source of income, and so they were teetering, about to lose everything unless they got some fast money. And for a beekeeper, the only place in America to get fast money is California, because that's where you'll find almonds. The almond rush started about 15 years ago, after the nut broke out from the rest of the nut pack and became an international health food superstar. Suddenly, everybody wanted almonds. Coastal elites, the aspiring middle class in the U.S., in China, in India, the Obamas.
You know, almonds are a good snack.
Almonds are now a $5 billion business.
It is huge money.
To satisfy this global appetite, it seems like much of California was made over into one giant almond orchard. 80% of the world's almonds are grown there. And what do California's almonds need? Bees. Lots and lots of bees are trucked into California every year from all over the country to produce lots and lots of almonds. Now, from Shoto to California is a long way. And Lloyd and Brenda both know that their bee babies...
They're not designed to be moved around. They move themselves around, you know, 3 miles at a time. You know, they're not designed to be loaded up and trucked thousands of miles.
On a rattling truck for days, you know.
That's not what bees are supposed to be doing.
But Lloyd and Brenda were desperate. They needed to make as much money as they could from the 480 hives they had left. And going to California would get them a quick $100,000 for those hives. Take one little bite of the California poison apple. Just one little bite. And then they could retreat home. So on a freezing cold day in January of 2017, Lloyd set out in his truck to California, the last shipment of hives strapped tight in the back, listening to the music he found most soothing.
Metallica.
The volume cranked up, his worries running in the background.
I just knew when we got down there, they weren't going to make it.
Couldn't do it.
It was too cold.
Freeze to death.
One little virus.
Apocalyptic
one little,
cold.
One little thing.
Wipe
one little
off
virus.
The face of the earth.
One little,
see
one
this
little
in my
thing.
Head. I want to stay the hell out of there.
I want to stay the hell out of there.
A couple days later, Lloyd pulled onto a gravel road in Yuba City, just outside of Sacramento, along a field of sunflowers. He climbed onto the truck bed and found himself pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, we took the lids off of them. They were just snug as a bug in there.
Lloyd laid the boxes out on the dry grass one by one, exactly 2.5 feet apart in neat rows, 10 in each row. His plan was to come back early the next morning and feed them.
And we quit at 4:30 in the afternoon when it was starting to get dark and foggy. And we went home, and I called her on the phone, told her how good the bees were, and
he was all excited. The bees have never looked this healthy in years. They're wonderful.
That we only had one dead one and three of them that were kind of dinky.
In heaven. Heaven. It was wonderful.
They were healthy, vital, just like my dad had been. Lloyd left that evening, secure in the knowledge that he had saved his beautiful life with the bees. Early the next morning, Lloyd got back in his truck to go feed the bees.
So I'm going down the road where I thought I was supposed to be going, and I was on the right road, and I pulled off, and I pulled in on this levee. I said, well, I must be on the wrong road, because the bees aren't there. So we drove to the next place, and they were gone. We drove to the next place, and all the way down, there's four places, and they were all gone. That was it. We didn't have anything. We had one hive of bees left.
It wasn't like a cancer, a known villain. Lloyd lost the core of his identity in the most absurd and improbable way. It took a couple of hours at most. It turns out, Lloyd wasn't the only person hungry for fast almond money. Thieves wanted in on it, too. They came in the middle of the night. They drove to the remote field, where Lloyd had carefully placed his bee children.
They're like a foggy night.
That's Alex Storyenko. He's a beekeeper in the area and also used to track escaped convicts for the Russian army. He didn't see the crime, but he's figured out how it would have gone down, based on tire tracks and just knowing a lot about bees. According to Alex and Ryan Cousins, also a beekeeper, who was asked by the local sheriff to help investigate the crime, the thieves probably used a big truck to pull off the heist.
Perhaps a semi-truck with a 48-foot trailer.
Some men would get out of the truck.
Four guys.
In vinyl white coveralls, white hats, veils, beekeepers. They immediately set to work. Go row by row and start stacking, loading Lloyd's bee boxes onto the truck.
Stack them in stacks of 3 to 4 pallets.
All the way to 488. Then tie the hives in so they don't fall off the truck.
4-inch ratchet straps that you throw over the top of the hives and you ratchet them tight.
And then head to the highway with the contents of someone's whole world in their truck bed.
Pretty gutsy of those folks, what they pulled off. Yeah.
It was the largest beehive heist in a single night anyone out there can remember. Lloyd's hives plus 200 others. For Lloyd and Brenda, it felt like an alien force had snuck in and hijacked their story.
I was pissed. You know, I can't believe that somebody would steal somebody's livelihood right out from underneath their nose.
What do you do when someone takes your livelihood, your identity, and leaves an empty space where your whole life used to be? We'll find out after the break. This is Invisibilia. I'm Elise Spiegel. When we left off, Lloyd and Brenda had lost not just their livelihood, but also the thing at the center of their identity. So they were reeling, looking for someone to blame. Here's Hannah.
Who was the enemy? Who was responsible for their suffering? And what had shifted in America to put a small-time family business like Lloyd's in such danger? Lloyd started to suspect that someone high up in the country was not doing their job.
They brought in a load of criminals out of the from the Eastern Bloc and brought them in here and dumped them right in the middle of us so they could steal us blind.
Lloyd got this idea in his head a few months after the Hive heist when a couple of guys named Vitaly Yaroshenko and Pavel Tveretinov were arrested for the possession of stolen property. They both pled not guilty, and the case is still making its way through the courts in Fresno. The prosecution contends that the men ran a kind of beehive chop shop, rent out the bees, dismantle the hives, and then resell the parts. That's how they supposedly made their money. Yaroshenko and Tveretinov, the suspects, they're part of this huge influx of Slavic refugees who settled in Sacramento over the last couple of decades. And some of them have gotten into the bee business. From Lloyd and Brenda's perspective, these newcomers, the Slavic beekeepers, they were turning the world of beekeeping into a lawless and reckless place, displacing and terrorizing small-time beekeepers like Lloyd and Brenda. That was part of what they wanted to talk to me about.
So what do you think about all this stuff that goes on about the immigrants, the illegal immigrants and the dreamers?
They seem to be grabbing at bits and pieces of ideas that are out there right now, like immigration policy, as the cause of their pain. Because their pain was so big and overwhelming, it demanded an explanation.
Why can't they make it right? Because they were getting a free pass.
Okay. Okay.
So what I don't understand is why they aren't trying to be legal.
Sitting in the kitchen over slices of pizza, listening to them talk immigration, I realize this must be something we're all susceptible to when we lose big, creating a grand narrative of good and evil with ourselves at the center of it. They just needed some way to deal with all this hurt they were feeling.
For me, it's like I just spent 25 years paying the bills and doing it, and I have my house paid for. I'm not going to mortgage it again. I have to sit here and go, you know, I have to start all over. Do I want to at 58 years old? You know, when we started this bee business, my daughter had to eat Roman noodles and for years, you know, and we built this. You take that all away from me in one night.
We talked for a long time, opened the windows, and then closed them again. I noticed their whole house was a kind of shrine to bees. There were bee pillows, a bee thermometer, a bee fly swatter, a collection of these hive-shaped wicker baskets called skeps. And it was clear as the evening passed that Brenda's mind could not come to rest. When she wasn't following the immigration thread, her mind would circle around her pain in other ways, searching for other possible answers.
Did I deserve this? Did I do something to cause this?
That seemed so obviously wrong. But when I questioned her, she didn't even hear me. She was so lost in this internal logic.
I mean, who could judge you for that? It's like somebody came and took, you know, everything you had.
Have I not been a good enough person? Do I deserve? That's me.
Did I deserve this? Did I do something wrong? Could I have fixed this? I, me. The way she was talking, it sounded very familiar. Brenda was doing exactly what my mother had done all year since my father died, scratching circles into her brain, not really able to take in the loss and what it meant. Not really able to think about who they could be now. Just getting stuck. It seemed like an impossible problem. When the thing that holds your world together disappears, how do you find your way out of your old story and into a new one? I called around, and there was this one guy whose answer made some sense to me. His name is James Pennebaker. He goes by Jamie, and he's a professor of psychology at UT Austin. He studies words and language.
And how we can use words to influence our ability to cope with upsetting experiences.
Jamie is married to a novelist. And the way he thinks about life is, we all walk around with a story about ourselves, and we're always shifting and editing that story. But then sometimes something huge and terrible happens. Something that knocks out such a big chunk of the story that it just doesn't hold together anymore.
Let's say that someone very close to you dies suddenly. that touches every part of your life, your daily routine, how you connect with other people, it's your health, all of these different parts of yourself. And it's hard to put those all together. So you'll walk down the street and you'll think about one aspect and you'll get upset. And then you'll switch to another thing, you'll get upset. But the ability to get on with it is the ability to put this experience into a simpler, perhaps more coherent story.
Now, some people can do that with relative ease. They can tell themselves, loss is a natural part of life, or I'll find someone new to share my life with. Or, instead of bees, I'll try llamas. Or whatever. But then there are the harder cases. People like Brenda and Lloyd or my mom, they reach this cliff where they have to face this critical question.
Do I change my story about my life? Or do I continue persevering with the old story, even though the facts don't fit very well?
Jamie wanted to know if he could find clues to the differences between the two groups, the ones who shifted and the ones who circled in place. So several years ago, he came up with a computer program that could measure, mathematically measure, the differences. When people are doing a good job coping with loss, exactly what words are they using and how many times are they using them?
LIWC.
Linguistic inquiry and word count.
Which I pronounce Luke.
In a few different studies, Jamie had people come in and write about what they'd been through, usually for 15 minutes a day for 3 or 4 consecutive days. And then Luke, the mechanical grammarian, divided up the words into different categories and cataloged them. In some studies, Jamie followed up with the essay writer several months later to see which ones felt better, physically and emotionally.
What really jumped out were there were huge differences in pronouns.
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 You know.
He, she, they, we.
Actually, he found the most important pronouns to track were I words. I, me, my. A person who uses I words at a higher than average rate
tends to be more personal, more honest, more self-aware.
In my book, a good person to hang out with. But according to Jamie, a person who stays in I mode all the time and never shifts, you need to worry about.
Depressed or depression prone.
I. That single letter word is a cunning little beast.
Why didn't I just...
Have I not been a good enough person?
I don't want to eat. I don't want to cook. I don't want to...
Did I deserve
Why
this?
Didn't I pay attention?
Did I do something to cause this?
I don't know.
Jamie has also sicked Luke the grammarian on poets to count their pronouns.
I am nobody. I have nothing to do with explosions. I have given my name and my day clothes up to the nurses.
That's Sylvia Plath. The poets who use more I words are much more likely to have taken their own lives.
Almost as though she keeps digging and digging into her misery, as opposed to trying to stand back and get a broader perspective on it.
The pattern the computer program picked up was the people who benefited the most were the ones who switched from I to he, she, we, and then back to I again. Not because this meant they were selfless or deeply invested in others, but because perspective switching
implies detachment.
You looking at yourself from a little distance, writing your story as if it were someone else's. If they were able to do that,
they started to develop a more coherent, structured story.
Different than the one that had been circling and circling around in their brains. There was another category of words that turned out to be critical to coping.
Think, understand, realize.
These were words that showed evidence of working through something, which led to Jamie's ultimate conclusion and the reason that his research hit home with me. Brenda had a story she kept repeating. My mom had a story she kept repeating. But if you're having trouble coping, it's no good to just have a story, a ready-made one about what had happened to you that you kept repeating over and over again to yourself and everyone else. You have to step outside at some point and actively construct a new story. There had to be some moment, somehow, where you saw what happened to you as if you were the author writing about it, not the character living it.
Disconstructed, does that mean made up?
No. A constructed story is putting things together.
Taking the pieces that exist and rearranging them in some new way that puts the ghosts in the background. that matches the facts and lets you find a new place to stand in the world that you are actually living in.
Pollinating's not for us because we don't want the go, go, go. We don't want that fast pace. We're these little farmers from Montana that, you know, like, you know, the slower pace.
Just tweak your story. It sounds simple, but it is so hard. When I was with Brenda and Lloyd, I could feel the ghosts of their old story still stubbornly hanging around. We walked through the old wooden barn that Lloyd's grandpa had built, a cold, dark space that was very neatly arranged. Along one wall stood a big stack of bee boxes.
So these are the boxes that were stolen?
Some of them, yes.
And where were the bees that were?
The bees are, I chased the bees out.
The boxes were stamped with the name of the company that the thieves had set up and the phone number. Lloyd hadn't gotten around to painting the boxes over or throwing them out, so the pile had just been there for months. I could feel Brenda start to circle again.
I grew up agriculture. I'm used to the not making any money and going for next year. But when a person does it to you, it's more like a rape.
You mean you just, in the sense it, you feel like you feel...
Yes, it's violation. It's not just Mother Nature or, you know, it's...
Person.
Yeah. It's an attack.
Lloyd cracked one of the boxes open.
There's a few crawling around in there, see?
Apparently, he hadn't chased all of them out.
Yeah.
For the first time all day, Lloyd seemed totally relaxed, in his element.
It's a beautiful white honey. Just run it. You can't even tell us what's liquid there.
Lloyd dipped a stick into the honey.
Taste it.
Oh, that's delicious.
The circling and circling that Lloyd and Brenda had been doing back to the moment of pain and loss, the experts might not recommend it, but sometimes it gives rise to something raw and beautiful, like honey or poetry.
I only wanted to lie with my hands turned up and be utterly empty. How free it is. You've no idea how free.
I find myself going to places like we used to eat together, even breakfast, and all of a sudden things that we really love to eat had no taste. I can't even follow them.
One of the main things keeping my mom stuck was she couldn't bring herself to do any of the things that she liked to do when my dad was alive. Eating a toasted sesame bagel at the bagel place, walking down Queens Boulevard, shopping.
Because I feel guilty everything that I do, because it's almost like betraying him. Why am I here enjoying life and he's not there with me? Do you understand? He's buried.
And then one day, my mom was just ready. I honestly did not expect it. I can say from a fair amount of experience that she has not historically been a pivoter. It happened the way Jamie Pennebaker said it would, but completely independently. Like, my mom didn't know I just talked to him a few days before. A thought just popped into her head while she was home alone during the holidays.
I reversed the feeling.
Meaning, she switched places with my dad. Switched from I to he and him.
That I said, if I will be the one who died, what I would like him to be, in what position? Would I like him to enjoy life, to continue doing whatever he continued to do with the grandkids, to go continue with the friendship, to continue normal? And the answer was immediate, on the spot, 100% yes. And that opened my eyes all of a sudden. Now I'm convinced that he would like me to do the same thing.
People had said that to her before. He would like you to enjoy life. But for whatever reason, this time, it stuck. She was fully able to step outside herself and see the same story from another perspective, my dad's. And that little thing changed everything.
When I reversed the whole thing and I said what I would like him to do, if it will be reversed, and the answer was 100% yes, I don't want him to suffer, that make my life much easier and accepting. And the jump will be a conclusion of the whole thing. And hopefully that will enable me, you know, to continue life and just keep going.
Here specifically is how the jump fits into it. how my mother took bits and pieces of her life and rearranged them, where The Jump closes one chapter on her story and lets the next chapter begin. Her new story begins in 1967 with a knock.
Knock on the door, and we were all shaken.
At the time, my mom was in a bomb shelter at her aunt's house. This was in Tel Aviv during a war.
And the entire country was in complete blackout. I mean, you couldn't see even 1 inch in front of you.
My dad had already been gone for 60 days. You see, he was a paratrooper.
Then I was a young bride with a 6-month-old baby.
That was my brother. And when the knock came, my mom did not get up. She didn't move.
We didn't want to open the door. That means that they're coming to give us bad news that, you know, your spouse or whatever is dead.
That's what a knock meant at the time.
And finally, when we opened the door,
it was my dad. The truck that was transporting his unit had broken down and wouldn't be ready for 24 hours. He had hitchhiked to Tel Aviv just to sneak in a kiss.
Just said, I'm here, I'm alive, I'm fine, give us a kiss, and he left.
I've heard this story over the years, but this time, she took it in a whole other direction.
And that's the only thing that was his that I never shared, because I never went to the army. I just had ideas and stuff like that. But I said, here I have an opportunity to do something that he have done that we never shared. And it's like felt complete that I'm risking it and I want to do exactly what he did at that time. And it make me feel good. I just wanted to do it.
So it's like completing a story.
Completing a story, yes. So here it is. I'm doing it for your sake. I'm not even thinking about the danger. I'm just doing it because I want to share everything that you did that I miss.
What do you think it's going to be like up there?
Cold. Windy. Cold, windy, and wonderful, and free. It's a free, free feeling. Absolutely. Yes. It's going to be awesome.
On the day of the jump, my mom took 2 old sweatshirts and sewed the letters E-L-I onto them. That was his name, Eli. In Hebrew, it suggests ascending to God, something up high. I sat in the back of the tiny plane as we climbed on high, trying not to look out the window, not to track how very far up we were going. In order to resist my strong urge to totally disassociate, I stared at my mom, who was just in front of me. She looked so happy. The skydiving guys took it to be a 2-thumbs-up kind of happy, but to me, it looked religious. Her lips were moving.
I love you, Ellie. I love you, Ellie. I love you, Ellie. And I'm doing it to you. I love you, Ellie. Yes, I love you, Ellie. I love you, Ellie. I love you, Ellie. I'm doing it for you. I love you, Ellie. I love you, Ellie. I miss you, and I'll be doing it for you.
The young guy in front of us tumbled out the door, just fell away. My mom was next. She took her position at the edge of the open door.
I love you, Ellie. I love you, Ellie. And we do it for you.
The wind was freezing and brutal, and I desperately wanted to pull her back in. She raised her chin, arranged her arms like wings.
I feel you. I really do.
She didn't look back.
That's Hannah Rosen. Coming up, the story of a TV show that tries to change the narrative of a country. Stick around.
Welcome back to Invisibilia. I'm Hannah Rosen. Today we're thinking about the stories we tell ourselves and how they have power over our realities, and how changing those stories can bring about a new reality. We now have a story about a singer and a journalist trying to take on terrorism with reality TV. Here's Elise.
Once upon a time, there was music on the radio, but then the music started fading out. First one radio station, then another, until there was almost no music to hear, and people started MacGyvering workarounds. One of the people who came up with a workaround was Hawa Abdi Hassan, a young woman who lived in a village outside Mogadishu, Somalia.
We used to use a memory card, fill the memory card with music, and listen to it from our phones.
In her home, as she cooked and cleaned, Hawa would listen to the great Somali singers, songs that entered through the ears, but then did strange things to the body, made your heart contract at certain moments, but at others, made your step lighter, made you feel like your worries could, in fact, be overcome.
My
favorite songs is one of the songs sang by Qatra Daher.
Can she sing a teeny bit of it?
Hestas wahir monoga qaadi karta?
Labadi istorte iskula bahade kalalal miwaye.
And truly, in Somalia during the 2000s, there were many things to worry about. Even the act of listening to music off a memory card was something to worry about, which is why Hawa was careful.
Yes, I used to listen, but I used to turn the volume low so nobody hears it.
Quietly?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The problem was Al-Shabaab, the Islamic extremist group that dominated large parts of the country. They didn't like music. In 2009, they banned music at weddings, banished musical ringtones, and started punishing people who listened to music on their mobile phones by making them swallow their memory cards. Then at some point, I guess they figured best to go straight to the source, so extremists started targeting the musicians themselves. The famous soloist Aden Hassan Salat was shot and killed in a tea shop. Others were murdered in the street. But through all of that, Hawa kept listening and practicing, because Hawa had a dream.
I just wanted to sing and become an entertainer.
For most of her life, though, because of Al-Shabaab, that was a pretty far-fetched dream. But then in 2013, this unexpected and interesting opportunity emerged. Apparently, there was going to be a new reality television show, an American-style reality television show that would feature singing and all kinds of singers competing. Hawa says as soon as she heard about it, she knew she wanted to audition, though she had to admit the idea also worried her. Can she explain what was she worried and afraid of?
Death.
What Hawa didn't know, couldn't know, is that this reality show, it was part of a much larger political plan.
Yes, sort of inoculation, you know, against the temptations of Al-Shabaab's austerity.
This is Ben Parker, who was director of communications for the UN in Mogadishu at the time. It was the UN that was behind the show. They provided the support and money. See, in 2013, though Al-Shabaab had finally been pushed out of Mogadishu, the situation in Somalia was far from stable. There were still regular attacks, so the new government, which had UN backing, needed to prove to Somalis that Shabaab's power really was fading, which is why a musical reality show that challenged the power of the music-hating group was so appealing.
The beauty of the reality show is that the form itself achieves some of your goals.
After all, not only was there music, there was democratic voting, individual expression. So even in its form, it communicated to its audience a very different kind of being. This kind of indirect political messaging, Ben told me, is increasingly popular with people like him.
Those working in conflict, modern conflict now, are less and less convinced of the value of weapons and more convinced that other approaches can deliver the dividends.
And so, with the UN's money and support, a small team of people were assembled to create this new Al-Shabaab fighting reality show. Mohamed Yahay, or Mo, was one of those people. His job was to manage logistics on the ground. And he told me he vividly remembers his first response to the idea of a Somali reality show.
this is probably going to get somebody killed. I think that was one of the first things that came into my mind.
Like most Somalis, Mo knew people who had died in the Civil War, so he had a deep appreciation of exactly how devastating the wrath of al-Shabaab could be. And while the international producers hired to film the show could be protected, surrounded by armed men from the moment they set foot in the country until the second they left, it was the people who couldn't load themselves onto a plane after the show wrapped that concerned Mo. He was worried about the contestants.
I was constantly worried about after they leave and after the program is done, what is going to be the outcome for these people? Or are they going to be identified at their house while they are back to their lives and doing whatever they do, called and threatened, and certain actions might be taken upon them because of what we have presented? That was one of the main things that more or less kept me at night.
But still, Mo had sympathy for the project. He wanted his country to get to a better place. So he tried as best he could to make it work. One of the first tasks, obviously, was to hold open auditions. But in Somalia, advertising an open audition for a reality show was kind of like giving the suicide bomber the actual street address of the party you're throwing.
Because if you do advertise it on the radio, then you're putting yourself on target. So we had to think of in a creative way to actually to minimize the risk that would normally come to that.
His workaround was to get the word out, but to create logistics that kept the actual audition site secret.
Go to that particular location and there's going to be a bus waiting there, and take that bus. That bus is going to bring you where you need to go and present yourself.
Mo thought that the strangeness of the directions in the ad would dissuade people. But on the day of the audition, when he went to the location, turned out that people were not at all dissuaded.
The queue was really, really scary. At certain times that we thought, oh, well, I thought to myself that I think we bit more than we can chew right now, so we need to put a stop to this.
But there was no putting a stop to it. Mo remembers making his way back to the gated compound where the buses dropped contestants and seeing people everywhere, sitting on the grass, lined down hallways. And he says he was just suddenly overcome with what this reality show represented.
Actually see them practicing, like they're warming up their vocal cords and working on their business ideas. Or how do I present this? That sense of fairness, that sense of it's his idea against my idea, and let these people choose it, and putting themselves out there, that seeing that was also really, really something else.
You mean it was really moving to you?
Yeah, yeah. It actually gave me a sense of hope that the country is not, and the people are not, as damaged as people put it out, or how the media normally covers it.
Of course, one of the people lining the halls that day was the young woman from a small village outside Mogadishu, Hawa Abdi Hassan. She says it wasn't easy to convince her family that going for an audition was a good idea.
Yes, my mom tried to stop me, told me, you can get killed for this. But I told her, it's okay, don't stop me. You know, what's meant for me will happen.
Did you get permission?
Yes, she gave me the permission.
And so the morning of the audition, Hawa put on the fanciest dress she had and carefully did her makeup. Obviously, she was nervous. Who wouldn't be on the day of a big audition? But there was an additional layer with Hawa. Had she ever sung in public before Inspire Somalia?
Yeah, that was my first time. Before that, I did not sing in public places.
It was too dangerous. And so as she went on, her hands were cold and shaking. But in her heart, she says, she still felt happy.
I was so grateful that, you know, I was even there to sing, to show that I can sing.
In fact, Hawa was chosen to go on to the actual competition, given the date to return. So, could this reality show, all the risk and trouble to Hawa, to Mo, actually change reality? Can you call a different world into being by telling the right kind of story? It turns out this question has been systematically studied.
I'm very interested in how we make the normal.
How do people come to see the world around them as normal? An unremarkable fact, the way things are and should be. Betsy Levy-Pollack is a psychologist at Princeton University who studies media and how societies change. And she says that for a long time, people assumed that the path to political change depended on crafting the right argument.
It was all rhetoric and no poetic.
But starting in the 90s, Betsy says, poetics started gaining ground because psychologists realized that people consumed stories in this qualitatively different way.
Their defensiveness is disabled. Their counter-arguing is at rest.
What Betsy wanted to understand was whether this difference in how we consumed stories translated into any changes in what we thought and how we behaved. So around 2004, she hooked up with this organization that was in the process of creating a new radio soap opera in Rwanda, a radio soap opera which, through its storyline, was trying to encourage tolerance between different ethnicities. And what Betsy found, after a year of studying communities assigned to listen to the program,
what it boiled down to was that despite the fact that people loved this program, it didn't change their beliefs, but it did change their perceptions of norms. And at the same time, it changed their behavior.
Let me repeat that. It didn't change their beliefs. It changed their behaviors by changing what they considered to be the social norm. For example, people who listened to the soap opera were way more cooperative when dividing up valuable resources given to them by the researchers, even when they had to divide those resources across ethnic lines. It moved the needle, which is a sobering idea.
Yeah. This is a very uncomfortable thought. We like to think that all of our behaviors flow from our convictions, and what we do is a reflection of who we are and what we think. But we're constantly tuning ourselves to fit in with the social world around us.
So what this work suggests is that if you change someone's perception of what constitutes the social norm, like you convince people that the world is safe enough to sing in public, even though in actual fact, singing in public is incredibly dangerous, then you might just change what they actually do in their day-to-day lives. They might, after seeing such a show, themselves decide to attend a concert. And in that way, you move the needle. So do you think the governments should be doing these kinds of interventions?
I think that they should. It depends on what kind of government, but governments that are accountable could be very good agents to initiate programming like this.
Do you think that foreign governments should be doing these kinds of interventions?
I think that becomes really tricky.
But foreign governments are doing these kinds of programs. The UN is doing these kinds of programs. The U.S. And of course, last year, there was the small matter of the Russians and the U.S. election. There's been a lot of debate about how much Russian tinkering actually affected things. But to Betsy, it's not at all hard to guess what they were going for.
I think in some ways they really purposefully engineered new perceptions of how common interracial strife was, or how pervasive hatred for Hillary Clinton was. That is norms engineering. That right there, comes straight out of the dictator's playbook.
Straight out of the dictator's playbook and into American life. A psychological terrorist attack concocted in Russia. Of course, when you turn the situation around and think about the UN's attempts at norms engineering in Somalia, it feels really different. So is norms engineering right, or is norms engineering wrong?
Allah
Don't I cry for my heart and get goosebumps all over? Those are the words that Hawa sang when, on the day of the actual competition, she stood on the stage in front of the judges. In the video of her performance, you see she slightly sways as she sings. She looks the way she felt, like someone who has finally been able to do the thing she's always dreamed of doing. After Hawa, two other contestants had their turn, both men. One had a famous musician father. The second, Mustafa, had composed his own song. After they finished, came the part of the show that was supposed to serve as a democracy demonstration, the voting. Ballots were distributed to the audience and judges, and for a minute, the room was quiet. In this small conference room in the middle of Mogadishu, people bent over their ballots and considered the options before them, and then marked the paper in their laps.
Mustafa.
Mustafa ended up winning. But Hawa says she was honestly not upset. For her, just the act of singing in public for the first time was enough.
I was very happy. I was happy as like I was born that day.
In the end, Inspire Somalia aired on many different Somali television and radio stations. And the response, according to Mo, was powerful. As soon as the show finished airing, he says he got a call from one of the managers at the main television station.
He said that people kept on calling them and saying that when is the next one going to come? Can we have more? My audience are asking me, they want to see more of these people present. Can we get more of it?
It was nice to hear. But for Mo, the moment the success of the show really hit home was when he went to the airport to fly to Nairobi and realized, after he took a seat at the gate, that the men sitting next to him were in a heated argument about who should have won the poetry part of Inspire Somalia.
And he was literally, he was really, really shouting to his friends to say that he should have won. There's no way. You don't know anything. You don't know nothing about poetry.
You know you've been successful when you hear people smack-talking their friends about poetry. In the years since the show aired, attacks by al-Shabaab have continued, but there has been some real progress. For example, music has returned to the streets. We leave you now with actual evidence, a song recorded a month ago at a cafe. It's such a small thing, a song. But listening to it, I can't help think that so many people were required to make it happen. The singer, of course, and also the cafe. But there are likely other people behind the song as well. Forces large and small seeking, through the song, to tell a new story. I imagine that new story spinning out of the singer's mouth, floating through the air, bending all the norms around it, shaping them subtly with the curve of a musical phrase.
That's Elise Spiegel. Here is Somali musician R. Munta.
That's it for us today. Invisibilia is hosted by me, Elise Spiegel.
And me, Hannah Rosen.
Our show is edited by Ann Gudenkauf. Our executive producer is Caratello. Invisibilia is produced by Megan Kane, Yowei Shaw, and Abby Wendell. Our project manager is Liana Simstrom. Lulu Miller is a contributing editor.
We had help from Alex Chang, Rebecca Ramirez, Mark Mehmet, Micah Ratner, Stephanie Hayes, Bryn Winterbottom, Hillary McClellan, Nancy Shoot, Meredith Rizzo, Nurit Eisenman, John Hamilton, Chris Benderef, and Maggie Penman for help with editing. Our technical director is Andy Huther, and our vice president of programming is Anya Grunman.
Special thanks to Abdurazak Dorhe, Trevor Snapp, Louis Brooke for his helpful insights, and Rupa Goganeni for gathering tape and sharing her recordings.
Also to the Storyenko family and Ryan Cousins for providing background details about the case of the Great Beehive Heist, to my mom for talking so openly with me, to my brother for being my brother, and to my dad, way up in the sky, I love you. And now, in honor of this musical episode, a musical moment of non-Zen.
I feel really compelled to sing for you now, but maybe I won't.
Please.
Okay. I have a little auto. It's cute as it can be. And when I drive around in it, I'm very, very happy. I have a little auto.
Join us next week for more Invisibilia.